There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free. And things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Well, good evening and welcome back to the show, and welcome back for the second hour with our guest John Oliver. He is the medium from the TV show Haunting Evidence on Court TV Wednesday nights. And again, for more information on John, where you can see him, his classes, and anything else he's involved in, please check out his website at johnjoliver.com. Again, that's johnjoliver.com. John, before I went to break, we were talking to you about your first call into helping the police and how you got that when you were 16 years old. When you started to do police work and helping out these cases, were they... See, this is the part that I stand back in total amazement watching people like you and Carla and other people I know that have been involved in helping criminal cases, especially because, you know, as we just watched on this last episode of Haunting Evidence, and forgive me, I can't remember the names of the two girls that went missing in the desert. But as you were recounting what was going on with them, it was very clear you had tears streaming down your face as though you're reliving what's happening to these poor girls. How do you do that and keep sane?
Well, you know what? I ask almost every cop, every detective that I've ever spent time with, mm-hmm. how they do it. I have a special relationship, for example, with the prosecutor's office, you know, in one of the counties in New Jersey. And I ask them all the time, how do you guys do this day in and day out? Because, I mean, they're the guys that I relive it in my mind. They go and they see it. You know, they come to the bodies with the slit throats and the people who've been shot and the people who've been, you know, have been hacked and beaten and everything else. And I just have to relive it, you know, in my mind. And most of the time when I react, it's because I start interpreting what I'm seeing rather than... you know, just reporting, you know, the facts. What I mean by interpreting is, you know, you suddenly realize it was somebody's daughter, or you suddenly realize that, you know, it's somebody's best friend, or someone's not going to see somebody ever again. Then, you know, your mind comes in there and gets involved with it. But I have to keep myself detached in order to be effective. And I have to remind myself that over and over. While I'm doing it, I have to try to maintain some objective distance so that I can be more effective and not get too carried away.
Does it, when you're sensing these things and you're seeing these things pop into your head, though, I mean, are you seeing the violence, or are you just feeling the emotion that's there?
Both. I get glimpses and images, and the emotion that's there is what I feel the most. And based on that emotion, if I'm feeling fear, and then I'm feeling particular sensations on my body, or particularly particular images that are telling me, okay, this person is being struck in the head, or this person is, you know, being punched in the stomach, or beaten over the head with a blunt object. And I'm feeling a particular type of fear. I put those things together to come up with a composite of what's happening in that situation.
Well, that's where I would think that after a while, that kind of work would be so taxing emotionally on a person, even though you say you can kind of detach from it, to see that kind of violence and feel that kind of violence over and over again. I give a lot of credit to people that do the job that you do, because I don't know that I could do it and walk away. Are there ever times that John Oliver wakes up and thinks, I can't do this. I can't go feel that again. I can't be a part of that and put myself out there that way.
Well, you know, when I feel that way, I've never felt that about for that reason, like you're saying. But I have thought, oh God, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. But for a different reason. And the reason is that I know that there are many cases, and no matter what I do, mm-hmm. they're not going to be solved because I can't manufacture evidence. If there's no evidence there, you know, if there's no DNA match there, if there's not some way to prove it in the physical world, and sometimes there's not.
Right.
You know, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do to solve that case. And I feel so badly for the family members that are left behind who are not going to have it resolved. That's when I think, oh, God, I can't do that, because I feel like sometimes I'd be giving a family false hope. And I'm in their last hope. And if their last hope isn't going to be able to do anything, you know, what happens then? And that's when I feel like, God, but I keep going because I realize, all right, there are those cases where I am, someone like me is the last hope, and it does make a difference. It does solve something. It does lead to resolution.
Sure.
Maybe it leads to a contact between that, you know, that mother and their child one more time through a message that comes through that they're able to verify that makes them feel, you know, that their loved one is okay on the other side. And in those cases, I feel good, even if, you know, someone doesn't end up going to jail.
Melissa, on our boards here, has a good question. What's the difference between what you do and what Carla does on the show?
You know, that's a very, very good question. And I've had the same question come up about the similar television show that I have in Japan. In Japan, I have a show called FBI Psychic Investigator. And what TV shows like to do is to sort of distinguish their experts. Okay, so, for example, in the show in Japan, I'm on that show with a psychic named Nancy Meyer, who's also one of the psychic detectives on the psychic detective series on, you know, on Court TV.
Right.
And they try to get us to do, you know, our little niche, even though we sort of both can do everything. Okay.
Okay.
I've been billed as the medium on the show, and Carla the psychic profiler. But my entire life to police departments, I've been simply known as a psychic detective or a psychic investigator. You know, something that way. But the difference between Carla and I would say is this: it's not so much the difference in what we do psychically, but the difference in the fact that she's a woman and I'm a man. And I notice that she describes things and picks things up in a way, you know, more the way a woman would, describing any situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to do that more the way a man would. Like, I notice certain, you know, facts, the guy's, you know, truck, what he might do for a living, and Carla's feeling the emotion and reacting to that. You know, a lot more than I do. I've noticed that. Here's a very good example to illustrate that. In Japan, I was out to dinner with my other co-star Nancy Meyer, and we were had finished wrapping a show, and we were out to dinner with the whole crew and producers, and just for fun, we went around the table and on the spot gave, you know, various people at the table a quick reading. And what was interesting at the end, we were laughing that Nancy went straight to their love life and I went straight to their career. Okay, and that's so...
Oh, sure.
That's so male-female. So those are the big differences I noticed between Carla and I.
Now, can I ask, John, when you're doing what you're doing, are you mostly tapping into residual energy, or does the spirit of the deceased come to you and say, John, it was... you know, Tim Dennis with the crowbar in the library, you know, I mean, is that what happens, or do you get a mixture of both?
I think it's a mixture of both, although I'll tell you that very rarely on any investigation has a spirit ever come to me and said, I need to tell you what happened. It's more than because, first of all, in most situations, that person's already crossed over. They've gone on. They're on their next, you know, their next journey, thank God, you know, mm-hmm. fortunately for them. So I'm sensing the energy, because I think that all information is available, you know, in the universe. So that person doesn't have to be disturbed, doesn't have to be called back, in order for me to get the same information that I'd be able, you know, to get if I did talk to them.
So you don't try to reach out to find the spirit of Jack Kennedy and find out who killed him. You just try to pick up on what happened there so that you can tap into that energy and kind of leave the spirits to be at rest.
Exactly right. Okay. I don't try to, unless I know it's a very high dimensional being. Like, I have no problem if, you know, I'm on a lazy Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning, to reach out to the universe and call angels into my house. But I'm not going to reach out there and call in any ghosts or anything,
right,
that. First of all, I don't know what kind of state they're in. Any more than I'm going to look out my window, you know, I live in Manhattan, and just randomly pick homeless people and say, hey, excuse me, can you come in here, please? And you come here, and you come here, and just come on into my house. I'm not going to do that with ghosts either. So I'm very, very careful about what kind of energy I invoke, because what people don't realize is, most people in daily life don't realize, whatever you're speaking out to the universe, that has an effect in the astral plane that's immediate, it's quick, and, you know, it comes to you. That's why, you know who ghosts love the most? I mean, the playful ghost on the astral plane, their favorite victims are scaredy cats, okay? Because if you see someone that's just quivering in fear and wrapping themselves in white light and holding a rosary because they're afraid and they're a prankster on the astral plane, that's exactly the kind of person they want to go up to and say boo to.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I know if I were on the other side and I saw a scaredy cat, I'd probably want to go up and say boo. You just couldn't help it, right?
Sure, yeah, just have a little fun. You know what, John? The part that totally blows my mind about what goes on the show, and I need some help understanding how you do this, and I know that you just started to allude to it, but I think it was 2 weeks ago on the episode that you did with the lady that vanished in the mountains. She left her husband at the hotel and went off to have some peace, and then she was found, you know, later murdered in the woods.
Yes.
What blows me away, you know, now I understand if they take you, like in this last episode, they take you out to this secluded piece of the desert where nobody goes, and they set you up, and they, you know, here's the grave markers for these two girls that were murdered here. And I understand not a whole lot of things have gone on there, so it might be easy to tap into that. But, John, you're standing out in a busy street in, like, New York, and they've let you go and haven't given you a whole lot of information to go on, and millions upon millions upon millions of people have walked those streets. Because what blows me away is they're like, this case happened in 1995. John Oliver is now going to try to tap into the inner, you know. And then you stand there, and all of a sudden you're like, I see her looking at this hotel, and I see this. And how are you able to sift through all the crap and all the residual energy of the millions of people that have had, you know, cried because they lost their job and, you know, broke up with their boyfriends and won the lottery and are looking for their dog? How do you sift through all that to find the one energy from that one person 6 years ago and know what they did and how they did what they did and where they went from there?
Yes, and that is a very, very good question, another very common question. I think the way that it works is intent, okay? And if you look at it in terms of the metaphor of the Internet, mm-hmm. when you go to Google and you type in a few keywords, the more, you know, if you type in just one keyword, you're going to get a lot of choices. Three, you're going to get fewer until you narrow it down to the intent of what it is you want to, you know, to pull up. So I think when I say, for example, I'll ask for the person's first name, and then I'll ask for the date. Tell me the date and the first name. And somehow I sense that my intent of focusing on that date and that name, and also the intent of everyone working on that project, whether it's with a TV crew or not. When it's with a TV crew and there's a producer and a director, and they're all, and the PAs, and we're all focused on that, we're in a sense invoking that information from universe, okay? Because if I had to sift through just all of the noise, let alone all the layers of residual energy from the many hours that have, you know, passed for so long, it would probably be, you know, almost impossible. But I think that it's some kind of invocation. We're pulling it down with that intent so that we can try to see, you know, what happened at that date to that particular, you know, name, that person that's identified. Now, I also think that if there is a particularly unusual aberration in the energy, an unusual disturbance, that it could interfere. Like, for example, even on the physical plane, if I were at a location where it was just way too noisy, maybe they want to put me next to where a jackhammer is going. You know, that right there would probably just not let me concentrate. And or if it was someplace that were, we were in a bumpy car or something that way, where we, you know, that might be too much. So if there's too much of an aberration that would disturb me mentally, then that will interfere more. but somehow it works with intent. I don't know exactly how it works. In fact, I tell you the truth, I am always amazed every single time that it does work. But somehow it does.
I'm curious, when you're standing there focusing, I mean, I got to guess it's almost like that hypnotic state where you're going down levels till you can link into that one vibration that you're trying to make contact with. Do you ever, as you're doing that, do you come upon other people that you know are now dead or maybe murderers? Or, yeah, I mean, do you come upon their energy as you're standing there and you're like, holy God, somebody walked through me that killed 14 people a week ago?
That happens sometimes. It actually does. And in fact, I thought it was happening in one of the cases. I think it was one of the earlier episodes this season of the two girls in the killing fields, as they called the episode.
Right.
And when I got there, they said, okay, we're bringing you near to the place where her body, we're approaching the location of her body. And it was like, whoa. My first impression was, you know what? I think that there are more bodies here. And that's when I asked for a piece of paper, and I kind of drew the landscape of the land and marked little X's where I thought bodies were. And one of those bodies I felt was not related to this particular case, that it was some other case. It was just happened to be a similar dumping area for a body, but a different killer. That does happen. You do sometimes pick up an energy that is so strong that it tends to creep in there. So sometimes I'll give some information in a case, and it's unverifiable at that time. So I'll say, let's just put that to the side. Put it to the side. Because maybe later we'll find out what it means, if it has any significance. Or it could be, just as you described, something that I'm picking up that kind of came in as a little interference or mental noise for some unbeknownst reason. So we put it to the side until we're able to verify it. We don't forget about it. We just put it on the notes and say, let's just look into it later.
Mama T emailed me a question here. She wants to know, kind of almost in this exact same vein, when you're doing this and you're investigating, when you meet the family, do you ever shake hands with the dad or the mom and know that they had a part in the death? Does that ever hit you?
It's never happened on the show.
Okay.
And actually, you know what? The answer to that, the quick answer is no, that's never happened. However, the show is kind of an interesting situation because there are certain things that I do on the show that I don't do when I'm working off camera with a police agency.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I take a case from a detective, I don't have to go out on the field.
Right.
Okay? I can stay in an interview room or I can stay in a living room with a pad of paper. And I can give a reading until I have to take a break, 2-3 hours, take a break, come back and do it again. Maybe there'll be some follow-up, stuff. Maybe I'll go on a location just to see if anything else can be, brought through. Mm-hmm. But I have a policy, actually, that when I work on cases, when I take cases from the public, I do not take cases from family members. I have some very strict rules about that. I will only take a case at the request of the detective in charge of that investigation, because that's the detective that legally has jurisdiction over it. And for the very reason you just mentioned, with the many, many cold cases out there, it's just the statistics are, I mean, the chances are that somewhere along the line I'm going to run into a situation where a family member is involved. Then it is not a wise idea for my part of the investigation to have be such that I was brought in by the family. It's much better and cleaner if I'm brought in by the detective and the family never knows that I was brought into the case. I have been in homes before,
mm-hmm.
Where family members just assumed that I was one of the detectives with the department, because they don't say, oh, by the way, this is, the psychic.
Right.
It's
like that TV show Medium where they bring Allison in as a consultant,
right.
But they don't tell what she's there for.
Exactly.
Okay.
I've even gone to, to jailhouses to interview, incarcerated individuals to see if, I actually did this for a DA, to see if I felt that person was innocent or not, and if they were innocent, what did I what did I see as the alternative possibility for that person? I've done that before. But I've never been introduced to the family as the psychic, except once, because it was a sort of a semi-high-profile case, at least locally, in the particular, you know, state that it happened in. And I was introduced, you know, as the psychic, because I was known in that area. But other than that, it's kept quiet. Of course, now that I'm on Haunting Evidence, if I was introduced to any family members, I'd take the chance that somebody would recognize me in this country, you know, from that. But no, I don't like to deal with family, because here's the thing: it's not anything against the family. I want to help them so much, but I'm able to, unless it's for the TV show, I'm able to help them more if they don't even know I'm trying to help them, and I quietly, you know, work with the police. Now, something else: I'm a professional psychic. I've built myself as a professional psychic since, you know, about age 17 years old. John Oliver, professional psychic. However, that does not mean that I get paid for police cases. I don't have a fee for police departments who want to contact me and request my help, you know, on a particular case. Now, there are a lot of requests, and it's sometimes hard to make room, you know, to get to all of them. I have dozens more requests to every request from a police department, from family members who email me, send me letters, who want me to get involved, but who will say, you know, the police will not call in a psychic. As much as I want to help, unless the police really want your help, there's nothing I can do about it, because that tells me one of two things. One, they have a prejudice against psychics for whatever reason. That's up to them. Either it's a religious prejudice, or it's just they're afraid, or they just don't believe in it for some reason, and that's okay. Or they truly do have a lead and don't need my help, but the family doesn't know that, because the police can't tell the family everything. And so I would only be interfering by, you know, behind the police back or against their will, going and working with the family and deciding to, you know, let's get in the car and drive around and look for the suspect. If I told the family, here are the directions to the suspect's house, what are they going to do with that? That would be very irresponsible. Could get somebody in big trouble that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I only take the cases from police, but I don't charge them any money. I don't have any fee for working with a police department, and I certainly have never taken any money from any family, you know, for that. I know that there are psychics out there who do take money for that, and that's complete, you know, that's up to them. That's their thing, and I can't say anything about that, but I myself do not.
Being a medium and being able to do readings for people, do the spirits of the cases you're working on, do they ever come to you at your home and say, John, help me? You know, do they come to you with that stuff at all? Or have you ever been followed home by a spirit, as asked by Queen Mary Lady here on our boards? Have you ever been followed home by a spirit on one of your investigations?
I have, on the Haunting Evidence, I have never been followed home by a spirit, but I have had dreams about them when I've been in the hotel the night before, the night after the investigation. That's happened to me, you know, I can just think right now, three or four times, you know, in the first and second season, where I will have a dream and someone will come to me and say, you know, I want to show you something, or you need to help me, or you need to tell my mother something for me. Well, you know, that's happened to me, you know, before. And I'll try to do that as best I can.
So you do have out-of-body experiences and lucid dreams where you'll also have these things happen. Okay.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, kind of going back a little bit here, I have two questions that came in from Shay and from Dreamcatcher on our boards. Did you have a psychic mentor that helped you when you were younger to develop these psychic abilities?
Not really. I would say that I had, that my psychic mentor might have been my grandmother, but unbeknownst to her. My grandmother saw spirits.
Okay.
And even when, you know, when she was, you know, as an adult, she would see spirits. But she would talk about the stories of when she saw spirits. And that's why I think that it wasn't so alarming to my mother that I saw spirits. It was, you know, accepted. She wanted it to stop happening because she didn't like it much herself that I was able to do that. But in that sense, it made it okay. But, you know, when I was in high school, I am so excited for the kids that are in high school right now who are psychics, who are seeing haunting evidence, who are seeing Sylvia Brown on Montel Williams, who are seeing all the psychics on Psychic Detectives, who are going to be seeing, you know, this show from, you know, Penn State University that Ryan Buell is a part of.
Right, Paranormal State, right.
Paranormal State, that's right. This is going to let us be the mentors, at least in the media, you know, for them to say that this is okay, because there was no one that I can recall when I was growing up that was on TV that said, you know, I'm a psychic and I do this, and, you know, and that. Maybe there were. But they might have been on new shows way past my bedtime.
Sure. Do you feel when you're out doing your investigations and doing these things, you've got to tune in. You've said it's all an intent. So you're feeling, you know, you're tuning into these things. Do you ever have trouble tuning it off? You're at a convention shaking hands. Oh, nice to meet you. Blah, 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 blah. Do you pick up on, holy crap, this guy abuses his kids, or this guy, you know, is a chronic shoplifter, or you know, I mean, this guy beats his wife. I mean, does that ever pop into your mind as you're going through talking to these people, because you're kind of always dealing in that criminal intent?
You know what? It does happen once in a while, but I would say it would mostly happen in very extreme cases.
Okay.
Very extreme cases. Like if I see someone whose energy is so depleted because they are, you know, being beaten up at home, I might notice that. You know. Something that way. If so much is happening to so many people, there's so many people under so much stress of one kind or another, that what seems to be within the acceptable norm is a pretty wide range. So it has to be pretty extreme for me to make particular notice of it. But it does happen.
Do you ever feel compelled when you see something negative like that pop up? Do you ever feel compelled that you should alert somebody about that?
You know what? Sometimes I do, but mostly I have to remember I have to mind my own business, because I can't very well go up to someone in the grocery store and say, excuse me, unless, you know, I'm sitting next to them on an airplane and we get into a conversation and, you know, one thing leads to another and they find out, you know, who I am, what I do. Maybe in that situation, I would take that as a message from universe that it's okay then to give permission, you know, to do that, any more than I think that, you know, any other type of professional is going to, you know, impose their skills on someone unless they've been asked. It's kind of a rule that a general rule that I have in life. Just don't, you know, interfere unless you're asked.
All right. John, we're going to take a quick one break for this hour, and we're going to come back to you and wrap up with the last half an hour. So everybody stay tuned. You're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show with our guest, John Oliver. And again, for more information, you can visit his website at johnjoliver.com. We'll be back with more of your questions right after this.
We thought El Chupacabra meant the cup of coffee in Spanish.
Me llamo Eduardo Especial. ¿Cómo está el yay?
What you talking about, Willis?
Shows you what we know. Stay tuned. There's more to come from the darkness on the edge of town.
If you read Taps Paramag every month, you'll be able to tell the difference between the absurd.
Could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the creepy. Taps Paramag takes you where few would ever go on purpose. From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters to the latest trends in technology, the field of the paranormal. To join our journey, order at tapsparamag.com.
Are you tired of reading about what couple in Hollywood is breaking up or divorcing? Have you ever wondered where you can find the news that covers the subjects that you are really interested in? I would like to invite you to visit supernaturalnews.com. Supernatural News uses the latest internet technology to search for the topics we know you will be interested in reading. News of the latest Bigfoot, UFO, or Loch Ness Monster sightings. Read about the latest conspiracy theories and urban legends. Supernatural News, where belief and reality merge.
Ghosts, goblins, witches, creatures of the night. Yep, that just about covers everybody Dave and Tim have ever dated.
Oh my God, this girl's really turning me on.
Welcome back to the darkness on the edge of town.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I just had a promise from Timmy D that within the next 2 weeks, we're going to have all new liners going in and out of commercials, ladies and gentlemen. Come on now. We're going to have all new liners coming in and out of commercials. So stick with us. Thanks. Yep. We've been hearing your questions and complaints. We'll get them changed.
Hold your breath.
We are listening to
I turned you off.
Yeah, well, that's nothing new.
I don't want you to promise.
You're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Our guest tonight is John Oliver. And, John, we do have a question from Andrew and Melissa popping up. How can you tell when a spirit guide is near you or if it's just the ghost of a loved one that's trying to guide you?
Okay, that is a good question. A spirit guide has a whole different feeling to me, totally different feeling. If it is a ghost, the only way I can describe it is it feels denser. And it feels more environmental if it's a ghost. Where if it's a spirit guide, while they can be there, it feels more like I'm communicating with something that's like distant or far away, like the difference between a local call and a long distance call. Although long distance calls have very good connections now.
Right.
It's more of that feeling. The energy just feels very subtle. And when it's a spirit guide, I can only say that I can't distinguish it between that and what I would imagine would be subtle, what I imagine would be gentle, because the fact of the matter is those impressions are laid into the same function in our mind that our imagination is laid into.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about kind of being a psychic role model for the newer generation so they can see. I mean, it's kind of like a coming out for people now that they've been able to see this on TV and it's more accepted. People are talking more about the paranormal, talking more about psychic abilities. But you mentioned somebody like Sylvia Brown, and I'm curious, Sylvia was kind of busted on Coast to Coast Radio a year ago or so when that horrible coal miner accident cave-in happened, and I guess she was quoted as saying that they were all alive but one or two of them, and then within 2 minutes the news came out that they were all dead. And then of course this last year she dealt with the embarrassment of saying that that boy that was found after being gone for the last 7 years, she had said that she definitely knew that he was dead and had sensed he was dead, and there was close of the case kind of thing, and then he turns out to be alive. Do you feel that that does detriment to your field? Does that screw you up, or do you, what's your take on psychics like Sylvia Brown?
Okay, first of all, myself, Carla, John Edward, Char Margolis, and every psychic on Psychic Detective could probably have 10 stories like that written about us.
Okay.
The reason is, you can be wrong. Just like when I said earlier that I have to put certain things to the side. I have to say, let's put this to the side because I don't know where it goes yet. Now, the case of the coal miners, I never heard that, but I heard about that. I did hear about it. I just attribute that to the fact that she was just wrong in that case. Okay, that's one case, we have to just say, okay, too bad she didn't hit. Now, in the case of this boy that was found alive that she said was dead, you see, here's what the public does not understand and what makes it particularly hard. Number one, when I looked at that, I felt that the media presentation of that against her was not fair. Now, I don't know Sylvia Brown. I've never met her in person. But it looked to me like it was unfair because they kept hammering in on the fact that, okay, she said that this boy was dead when he actually was alive, but they forgot about the fact that she described the man's general appearance of what he looked like and his first name. His name was Michael. Now, why was she wrong about the fact that he was dead? Ultimately, I don't know, but here are some possibilities. Maybe in that same area where they were searching for him, there might be some other body. Maybe it was mental noise about the fact that maybe this man intended to kill him. Psychic impressions are extremely fragile, okay? And when you have...
could it also be something real quick, John? Could it be the fact, and I hate to even say this because it makes it sound like I'm trying to come up with excuses for her on this, but could it be the fact that after the abuse or rape or whatever had happened to this poor boy, who he was had gone? That child's vibrational level had changed. So she wasn't able to track that vibration anymore, which made her feel like he's gone. It was a new vibration because this kid was tormented in a sense, kind of a different person now.
See, that's a possibility too. like I said, there's many possibilities of why they might be mental noise. And here's another possibility. And this is actually the one that I believe in, the one I'm about to tell you. I saw the news clip on Anderson Cooper where he was showing the family in the audience, you know, the Montel Williams show, where they're asking her, they're describing the facts of the case to her, and they say, is he alive? And Sylvia, you look at her, she shakes her head no. Now, it wasn't a very convincing no to me. When I saw that, I'm interpreting for her. She has to speak for herself. But when I saw that, it's like, oh, gosh, she doesn't act like she's that sure about it. But here's what happens. Here she has a camera on her. An entire talk show audience is under pressure to give an answer to something that important before a live audience. And, you know, she could have been picking up the fact that the family themselves probably thought he was dead. And she was picking up that energy. There's all sorts of ways that she could have been tuned into the energy that he, you know, was dead. Now, what I just told you earlier about working with family members, that's one reason why. Now, here's my criticism of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
My criticism of the whole thing is, I don't know that it's wise to bring families on a talk show live and ask someone, is my child dead or alive? I don't care if that psychic has a 99% accuracy rate, because that means every 100 people is going to be disappointed. And we're talking about people's emotions and their lives and those possibilities. Now, there are many cases where I have been wrong, and if someone wants to exaggerate the times I have been wrong, you're going to forget about the times that, you know, I've been right and I've been able to help, or when Sylvia's been right and she's been able to help, because we know that there are a few people out there that have made a career out of trying to get her for some reason, you know.
Well, maybe you bring up a good point, too, and Net935 on our boards is asking, is there any sort of code in which there are things that you will or will not relay to others in either a private reading or on the television show? If you're in a situation like that, what is your code, and how do you decide what you're going to share and what you're not?
I always try to remember, in any work that I do, I try to remember my Taekwondo grandmaster, okay? And he describes that any job that you do, you must try, first of all, to work very hard at it, but to do it with great etiquette. And so I don't think it's good etiquette to tell people that I'm 100% sure that your son is dead, or even to answer that question. I prefer to say, I just don't know. Even though I might have a feeling one way or the other, I really will say, I don't know. Because the fact of the matter is, until it's proven in the third dimension, I don't know. Because it could be the time that I'm wrong. So I don't like doing that. I also do not tell people in readings, if you know, they say, well, can you tell me when so-and-so is going to die? I don't do that either. I don't think that that's my place. Some people may think that is their place to do things like that. But again, because the stakes are so high, I could frighten someone or make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't feel it's my job to tell when someone is going to die. Now, I also don't think it's my job to tell somebody something like, your husband's cheating on you. Okay, that isn't a psychic's job, you know, either. Again, the stakes are too high in the event that I could be wrong. Maybe he was thinking about it. Maybe there's somebody after him, and I've misinterpreted the vibrations, and here I say something like that and create a problem, you know, where there wasn't a problem. Where I feel I can be helpful is when I'm privately working with a, you know, detective and saying, here are the things that I feel. Let's try to check them out and see if they're helpful. And if they're helpful, then, you know, let's, you know, do something, you know, about it.
Right.
Rather than giving information to people that they can't do anything about. I mean, what is someone going to do, you know, a stranger, when I tell them so-and-so is cheating on you? I have, however, told people, you know, I think you really better keep track of your money. I think you better make sure you know where your money is going and what's happening with it. And I have had cases of business people who've come to me and realized that they were being stolen from, but I didn't point any fingers. I didn't say, you know, it's the accountant that you know, is 5'7", blonde hair, and wears glasses. I don't want to do that to people. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But I can help them in some way to empower themselves in a more general way, because here's the thing that I am so aware of, Dave. Mm-hmm. I am aware of the fact because of the many, many times that I have been accurate, and I feel like I'm more accurate than not accurate. That's my feeling about it. Because of the many times I've been accurate, people who are aware of my hits, of my successes, will take what I say very, very seriously, and I think that I have a great responsibility in how I communicate readings or feelings or sensations to people, because I realize that what I say has the potential to change somebody's life. It's certainly sure. a certain mood or their feelings.
You know, Mary Beth asked a quick question, kind of as follow-up as you mentioning about people asking if they're going to die. Do you have that happen? Do you meet people and you know that, boy, on June 4th, that's going to be the last day I'm going to see this person? Does that come to you on those, that kind of stuff pop up to you as well?
Sometimes it does. Sometimes I really get a feeling that somebody's sick, and that, you know, they may not, you know, be around very long. That has certainly happened to me.
Okay.
On rare occasions have I gotten the feeling that it was going to be around a particular time, or it was going to be,
okay.
you know, the way or how the day was going to be, if it was going to be a cool day, hot day, if it was going to
sure.
be a new full moon. I get stuff, you know, like stuff like that. But
okay.
I try, like I said, not to focus on that too much.
Do you, Don wants to know on our boards as well, do you ever get feelings or messages before or after a show that you've done that might be important to the case?
Yes, yes. When, for example, the night before some of these, you know, cases on the show, I sometimes have a dream. In fact, it's my standard thing now when I'm on these episodes of Haunting Evidence. I try to have some notebook very near the bed. Because, you know, everyone gets up usually at least once in the night to you know, to pee or, you know, and then go back to bed.
Right.
During time, if I wake up, you know, during a dream, there's a chance that I could have been dreaming about the case. And it's happened to me, like I said, on several occasions. I will quickly make notes. I'll quickly jot down, you know, some things. There's been a couple of episodes where I have actually dreamed a blank board, a whiteboard, where there'll be someone in some presence in the dream, just some narrator saying, okay, this is where you're going to start, and I want you to follow the road for this many miles, and I want you to turn left here and go up to a tree looks like this. Then I want you to, you know, look for, you know, the well with the red cap on it and go 3 feet, and this is where you're going to look. I've had things like that happen. Couple of times, and sometimes after the show, you know, airs, after the episode we wrap for the show, the next day or so, I might get some impressions and say, "Oh my God, I just got, you know, something else." That happens to me all the time.
Do you contact them then and give them the newer information that you've got?
You know, I have on some occasions when I thought that it was appropriate or that could add some more, you know, dimension. I'll tell you which case really stays in my mind a lot. Of course, all of them do. You know, the
sure.
Tara Baker case, of course,
all
stays
right.
in my mind a lot. You know, her energy was just so strong in trying to reach out to her mother. I just felt so,
right.
I think about her from time to time. And also the case in North Dakota, you know, Russell Turcotte, the Native American boy,
mm-hmm.
because the spiritual presence was so strong there. And you know, just the tribal consciousness and the familial consciousness of you know, his relatives that came and basically made that ground sacred ground. That case, you know, stays with me, and I think of them often and hope that they're doing well.
Let me, you know, we've got about 6, 7, 8 minutes, something like that, Tim, going here? Okay, about 10 minutes. I've got 3 different questions I want to make sure that I get to, and I'll try to knock these down in order as we go. Have you ever had a case that was, you know, particularly difficult for you? Something that something about the case that always bothered you, but you were never able to pick anything up from it. Dreamcatcher wanted to know that.
You know, there have been cases where it seems to have taken me longer than to pick up anything, or it's like, oh my God, I'm blank. I don't get very much. Now, here's something that most people watching Haunting Evidence don't realize. In
mm-hmm.
fact, if I weren't there to see this, you know, in person, when you watch the show, it gives the appearance that all these impressions are just coming just so quick, okay? because they're editing it together to make a show.
Right. They probably film for 8 hours to get the 30-minute show that you've got, right?
But Well, the show is 22 minutes, you know, in a half an hour with commercials. But it's not coming out that fast. And at the end, when we're wrapping up, you know, I'm wrapping up and reviewing a lot of impressions that I've already picked up all day, okay?
Right.
And kind of rehashing those. And in that last scene, that's when I try to describe, you know, as much identifying information as I can, all the way to physical appearance and appearance of the face, you know, of a perpetrator. That last thing that I do.
Right.
But it does not come quite as easily as it appears on the, you know, on the show. The show makes it look like it's 1, 2, 3, this happened, that happened, you know, but it's not like that at all. It's a process. It takes time. And sometimes, honestly, I wish I had a little more time.
All right. No, I did. I had a question earlier, and this one kind of repeating the same question, but do you have experiences with numbers, such as like 444, that have to do with investigations or numbers that play a significant role for you? Or could the spirits be trying to communicate to you by giving you the death date and you start seeing it everywhere?
That kind of thing about death dates doesn't happen to me, you know, so much.
Well, I was just
much,
using death dates, yeah, but I mean some kind of significant date or something like that that the spirits will keep showing to you in third dimension form here that you'll keep noticing.
Yes, for me it's a number 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now, is that a mnemonic trigger for you? I mean, is that just because that's like your number and you happen to notice it more because that's your number? You know, like me, I have a Vikings purple PT Cruiser, and when I bought it, I didn't see any others that were this cool Vikings, you know, football color. And I bought it, and then, you know, within 5 days, every other car I saw on the highway was a Vikings purple PT Cruiser. But I think what it was, I think they call it a mnemonic trigger. Once you've got that in your mind, you see it everywhere because now your mind recognizes a pattern.
That's right. And that certainly is, you know, a possibility. But I have noticed that when the number 11 shows up,
mm-hmm.
it will be around, because I am very aware of numbers, much more than people realize. I'm looking at numbers, I'm watching numbers, I'm seeing the, you know, the numbers on, you know, on clocks. I see the numbers on license plates, anything that might, you know, be something of significance. And for me, it's a number 11, or when the number 11 comes up as 11:11, like, if at the hour it's 11, I don't know how many times I look at the clock and it's 11:11.
Sure. All right. And then I've got a question here from Zen Kermit. And Zen Kermit wants to know, have you ever had an experience where one feeling that you thought was about one case ended up being about a totally different case?
You know what? I suspected that was the case in the Killing Fields episode because, you know, as it turned out, there were several bodies that were discovered in that, you know, in those fields. And when I first came there, they led me to believe, well, I don't know if they led me to believe, they told me that I was working on this particular case and gave me this particular girl's name, where unbeknownst, Carla was doing an entirely different case. Unbeknownst to both of those situations, there were other people that had been dumped there in those fields as well. It's what was called the Killing Fields. So in that situation, I felt I was picking up some stuff about another case. In fact, I could have almost done an entire different investigation on one of the bodies that was found in those Killing Fields because I feel it was a different killer. So that has happened, but very rarely.
Okay. Well, but if you're focused on the murder of Tim Dennis,
what?
And then, you know, but it just so happens that there's another case you're going to be working on in a week. Because as a psychic, I'm sure you start picking up vibrational energy. As you said, sometimes you'll have a dream a night or two before you go out on a case. Could it be that you're picking something up you think is for Tim's case, and then when you start working the Dave Schrader murder a week later, you go, holy crap, that totally makes sense because this person I saw, this perpetrator, is their number one suspect in this totally different case. Does that bleed through to you?
It can, but like I said, it that kind of thing has very rarely happened because, most of the cases
mm-hmm.
are geographically and in time far, far apart from each other. And I don't mean just on the show, but I just mean in real life as
sure.
well.
And then we've got the stock question we had to ask Patrick. We're asking Carla, and we've asked you now. What's going to happen? Are we going to see solutions to any of the shows that you guys have done? I know this season you did one of the episodes was a solution case to one that you did in the first season, right? But are you
right.
Are you going to be doing have you guys gotten word? Is there more information coming out on any of the other cases you worked on either last year or on the earlier part of the season yet? And will we see more follow-ups?
You know what? I hope that we see some more follow-ups. The follow-up that we saw this year, I didn't even know was going to that was even coming out till about a week or so before it actually did. Here's the thing about haunting evidence. It's very interesting to me. Unlike the show Psychic Detectives, haunting evidence actually brings the cameras in at the very beginning of the investigation. Whereas Psychic Detectives, they're all cases that have already been solved, and if you'll watch, follow the story of Psychic Detectives, sometimes that story unfolds over a period of a year, 2 years, 3 years. And from the time a perpetrator is discovered, the evidence is proven, he goes to trial, blah, 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 that, you know, can be a process. Now, honestly, I do think that there are some of these, some of the cases that have been presented to us on haunting evidence are such that I don't think they're going to be solved. I do think there are some more that will be solved and that can be solved if the leads are followed and they work on them. But I don't hear anything about what's going to happen until it actually does. It's like the people on the show are the last to know.
Sure.
And
yeah, but John, you're a psychic. You should know the answers are coming, right?
Oh, that's right. You're right. Okay, yes, there are going to be follow-ups.
Excellent.
And there are going to be more successes.
Good. Hey, now, I know you said that you feel that you've got a pretty high success rate. Do you know, I mean, out of the hundreds of cases you've been brought into, do you know how many have parlayed themselves into a closed case yet?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have any exact statistics on that, but I know that there are hundreds of cases that I feel would have been continued to be unsolved if I hadn't been brought into them.
When you're brought in, how are they justifying that now with the courts? I mean, it's got to be undercover stuff, right? We can't let the world know that we've called in a psychic to help us because we're, you know, it'll make our police department look inept that we couldn't solve the crime. We had to go to, you know, Mandrake the magician to give us the answers. How is that getting easier or better, do you think?
It's getting easier because of the media coverage. You know, like I said, do you remember, Dave, 10 years ago when the general public did not know the phraseology crossing over?
Right.
Everyone knows crossing over now.
Right.
We have largely to thank John Edward and the show Medium and Ghost Whisperer for that. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows crossing over, what it means to cross over. You hear that all the time now. And because of that, and because of Psychic Detectives, because of Haunting Evidence, because of Sylvia Brown, it seems like people just expect now that it's a possible. Everyone, almost every person in the culture, has heard now that psychics work on police cases. That's just pretty common knowledge. Even if they couldn't tell you a specific case or know about one themselves, they've at least heard of that. And so that, in that sense, makes it easier than it was, you know, before when I was a teenager, when, you know, it really had to be quiet because what about if, you know, exactly as you said, what are they doing calling a psychic in? Now it seems that we've heard it said so many times that a psychic is another tool in a criminal investigation, the same way that, you know, today we have DNA that we couldn't have used 20, 30 years ago.
Do they ever call you in, though, to court during the case to use what you've said, or are you still basically a dirty little secret to the court system?
No. My hope is that no one will ever find out that the prosecutor, the defense attorneys will never find out that I was, you know, called in, you know, on the case. It's not necessary. And
right, but like shows like Haunting Evidence, John, I mean, it's on the air right now.
Right,
and
exactly.
You guys are doing
You're
it.
Right.
Is that affecting the cases from being solved? And do you think that it could lead to cases being dismissed because it was some TV person with a vendetta?
If, for example, I said, you know, the killer lives in that house and a policeman goes and searches it without some other probable cause, then yes. But, for example, in this case, the Katie Seppich case, they had irrefutable DNA evidence that linked the guy, you know, to the crime and his confession. So in that case, you know, it became, you know, irrelevant anyway. So as long as I am the tool to lead them to the evidence, I don't think it's a problem.
Well, John,
but I can't be the only evidence.
John, we've only got about a minute left here on the show. Okay. Is there anything you'd like to pass on to people? Any little bit of wisdom you want to share with them?
Well, I'd like to say for everyone to take their, to listen to their intuition 100%, but also to take every individual piece of psychic information with a grain of salt. And in that way, you know, I think that intuition can be used in a very enlightening and enlightened way in everyone's life.
And if people want to contact you, John, they can get in touch with you through your website. Is there an email address there as well?
That's right. They can email me through my website, john@johnjoliver.com.
So if there are any police officials out there looking for help, they can reach out to you that way as well?
That's exactly right.
Great. Well, again, everybody, check out Haunting Evidence. It's on Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock on the Court TV channel. Again, I think they replay them on Sunday nights just before our show starts, so make sure that you check your local listings. John, thank you so much for spending time with us. I can't wait to see you again and hang out with you at the Stanley Hotel, and love to have you be a part of that with us. Thank you again.
Thanks, Bob. Have a good night.
You too. And thank you all for tuning in. I hope you had as good a time as Tim and I did this evening with the show. It was great having John on with us and sharing the different thoughts and perspectives and hearing how they're used in a criminal investigation for psychic detectives. It's always amazing. I want to thank everybody again for tuning in. Make sure that you stick with us for next week because we've got a great show coming up next week. We've got Dr. Barry Taff, who's going to be on hand for 2 hours talking to us about some of his most amazing cases and giving you information on the paranormal. We pre-recorded that show because I will be out of town with Tim as we're going to be at Waverly Hills investigating it with our listeners. But that it will be a brand new show for you. It will air next Sunday with Dr. Barry Taff. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to be back live with Stanton Friedman and William J. Burns, talking about UFOs, talking about some of the newer things that are going on, and William Burns is going to talk to us about USOs, unidentified submersible objects, and the history of these crafts that have been following government ships for years. Stay tuned. Keep up with us on our site at darknessradio.com. Thank you to all of you for your questions this evening, for being a part of our chat. We'll look forward to seeing you all again next week. Thanks again, and have a good night.